The 1995 Sun Student Symposium presents session number 323, Danites, Donut Holes, and Mao, Remaking Roman Culture as Resistance, by John Brooks.
The paper that our presenter, Joanna Brooks, is going to give is entitled Danites, Donut Holes, and Mao, Remaking Mormon Culture as Resistance. Joanna Brooks is former student and a voice member at Brigham Young University, and presently she's a graduate student in a PhD program in English at UCLA. It looks like we don't have a commentator for this session, and so hopefully after the paper's over you'll field some questions from the audience.
Thanks to Lori for the impromptu. And because of the size of the audience, I'd like to make this as chatty as possible. I feel really uncomfortable. I teach my freshman students Paulo Freire's article, The Banking Model of Education, which talks about how bad it is to have one person at the front of the room talking and everyone in these fixed chairs at another level listening, and how it really should be more conversational. So we'll take it at that pace, hopefully, and with good humor. If you have a question, I'd be glad to field it in the middle of the paper. It's always an interesting thing to be at Sunstone and to be an academic presenting at Sunstone, if that's what I can call myself at this point. Sunstone is remarkable for the sense of community I get when I'm here. It's really refreshing. I think Albert's talk last night really characterized that for me. That is certainly one of the pillars of my faith. But I wonder about the condition of our community sometimes. I wonder about what we're doing here. I wonder about what academics are doing here. Maybe my questions about the condition of the Mormon left come from the condition of my own small community that I graduated from BYU with. We went through some pretty heavy-duty experiences together, and now we find ourselves diaspora-like, spread across the country in PhD programs, nodding along with various causes. We joke that in a couple years we'll have the first set of PhD dissertations published with quilted scrapbook covers on them, and we all talk about if we're going to embroider the title page and have a little photo and the frame inset on the scrapbook. But we do have a sense of scattering, I think, that's setting in. I'm not sure that a lot of my friends aren't here at Sunstone this year. I don't think people know exactly what to do with the idea of a Mormon left. The tags we usually use are liberal or intellectual. Liberal is interesting because I don't think we have much accord on what our politics are here. We don't have any sort of a secular political agenda that we hold in common. What I read liberal as here is just pluralistic more. Everyone who doesn't quite find exactly what they're looking for in the manual and correlation comes to Sunstone. Intellectual is also an interesting term because not all the talks here are intellectual. That's not what we're looking for at Sunstone either. Puts people like me in an interesting position. How do we talk to each other as academics, wanting to make the Mormon experience serious and worthy of theoretical consideration, but also something that we can actually enjoy and think about practically? And so that's where I'm speaking today, as an intellectual aware of and suspicious of the heavy cost that we take on ourselves when we try to do theory and theology, and we just bang our heads, against the people who have a living doing theology in this church and in the church office building. The tremendous cost we incur to ourselves when we really try to talk like heavyweights. But at the same time, wanting to make my Mormon experience a part of what I study at school, because I think it is worthy of study. Starting, I'd like to just recite a quote from a theorist named Gayatri Spivak, who's been kind of influential for me. And she talks about being suspicious of thinkers who come up with these grand answers to everything in the world all the time. And she says instead that what we need is just vigilance. And I really appreciated that description, this description of vigilance rather than grand theories for every problem. And so that's what I'm trying to see the Mormon left evolving into. We don't have the unified theory of Mormon existence. We don't, we try sometimes to pull together wide cultural explanations for this or for that in history, and someone's come up with a new answer, right? If we just went back and did it like they did in 1844, everything would be fine, or whatever the solution of the week is. But I see the left serving a more vigilant function, frankly, and a more cultural function than that necessarily. I think it's our culture that keeps us together and keeps us coming back to Sunstone, rather than the intellectual side of it or even the political side of it. I think it's a real cultural issue. But at the same time, I think our culture in the Mormon left is under crisis for three reasons. First of all, diaspora effect. A lot of the younger Sunstone people weren't born and raised in Utah, and I know a lot of the older ones weren't either, but I think there's a little less sense of the Mormon history that you get unless you actively study it, being a Mormon from the colonies. That's something we might have to wrestle with as time goes on, that less of us will be engaging the historical side of things actively. Second, I think, you know, the more conservative elements of our culture make it inhospitable to be a left-wing Mormon, especially anyone who identifies as an intellectual. Bad thing, alternate voices, all that. You all know how that is. And third, I think that sends us in the Mormon left looking for a more sexy, more exciting kind of left-wing life, something more cosmopolitan. It's really hard to try and think of yourself as a Utah when it feels, or, you know, a Utah Mormon or a Mormon when it feels so inhospitable to be here and what we consider our culture sometimes. So you go looking for, you know, where your other left-wing friends are and lose a sense of that which is uniquely ours. So I think these three tensions, the tension of diaspora, the tension of, you know, a still inhospitable right, and the lure of left cosmopolitanism do threaten the cultural function which places like Sunstone serve, and certainly these are issues we'll be addressing in the next 10 and 20 years. As a segue into the academic part of my paper, which will be an examination of Terry Tempest Williams' refuge, basically, and just examination of the strategy she used, how she wrote herself as a Mormon left person, where she put herself on the map in the culture. You know, was it in Relief Society? Was it in Blip? I think it's interesting how Dave Knowlton's talk went, talked about syncretism and imperialism in the church's expansion. I think sometimes, especially younger Mormon left people, are practicing a different kind of syncretism where we're looking for ethnic left movements, you know, Native American left movements like in Terry Tempest Williams' book, and we're practicing almost a reverse syncretism, looking for somehow, somewhere to explain what we feel because we just are not finding it. We haven't thought about our own culture as revolutionary enough or as left-wing enough, and this, I think, is a grand oversight. And this is one final comment before I go into the Williams part. This is going to be a fairly academic paper, and I know this is an irony talking about, you know, how we're going to make our own culture revolutionary. So if you would imagine a nice lace tablecloth with a plant and a picture of a young woman medallion thing over there and a nice object lesson of some kind, imagine yourself in a young woman's classroom and we'll be fine. I started this consideration for a class I took on Native American literature, and I was especially interested in Williams' text because it did rely so much on Native American typology as the answer, as her refuge, her release. And, you know, writing this for a non-Mormon instructor was an interesting experience. And I introduced my thoughts on her book by explaining what was happening in 1993. Things we all know. Refuge came out then, and Terry Tempest Williams came to BYU and read, in which was, some people thought, just a major indulgence on the part of BYU officials. I mean, Carolyn Pearson couldn't even come to campus. No one could come to campus and read, but Terry Tempest Williams could and did and read to packed houses. A month later, in April, BYU rejected Pulitzer Prize-winning Mormon feminist historian Laurel Thatcher Ulrich as a keynote speaker for its annual church co-sponsored women's conference. In May of that year, Boyd K. Packer delivered the now infamous speech about the feminists, gay and lesbians, and so-called scholars and intellectuals as the three greatest dangers. In June, BYU refused to renew the employment contracts of two professors, Cecilia Contrafar and David Knowlton. In late June, 27 members of a radically fundamental community in Manti were called to church councils or excommunicated. And by September, 7 more liberal and feminist intellectuals or activists were called to disciplinary councils in what some members of the national secular press called a purge. And so in the middle of this descends Terry Tempest Williams' book with, you know, this grace, almost with healing in its wings, as it seemed. A very romantic but not confrontational, I think, depiction of Mormon feminism. And it was very well received, and Its curative function, I think, was bolstered and extended by the fact that Terry Tempest Williams was never called in for disciplinary counsel and never excommunicated. I think it resonated with its home audience and with other liberally inclined naturalist readers nationwide for less Mormon reasons as well. The resolution to Williams' concerns in Refuge was scripted in its often reprinted epilogue, The Clan of One-Breasted Women, a dream sequence wherein women from all over the world circle the blazing fire in the desert to dance, drum, and sing a song given to them by Shoshone grandmothers. Williams maps herself finally as a member of a border tribe amongst her own people. Refuge, for her, is coded Indian. Now, certainly this isn't the first time, and certainly wasn't the first time in the 90s, that Utah's white liberal culture intentionally deployed kind of Indian cultural forms to talk about itself. I remember really vividly, especially around the Gulf War time, protests in Salt Lake City, where you have always the standard Native American drummer crying repentance to the people, you know. I remember a Take Back the Night in Salt Lake City, I think it was in 93, where there were all these kind of new age chants about women's body being earth and her spirit being fire. And it was all very interesting, but a lot of us were looking around at each other and going, what is this? You know, how did we get turned into Indians all of a sudden? Why are we all buying sage bundles and fetish necklaces and scripting our resistance within Mormonism in this Indian way, in this kind of romantic, exoticist way? Beyond these isolated incidents, I think wider portions of Utah's white population, not just liberal population, but white population, were falling in with nationwide new age trends and participating in a commodity fetishism of native identified products, from Salt Lake City health food stores to Park City boutiques. Everyone was selling authentic stuff. So this kind of a curative invocation of Indian culture by white folks has been really criticized by Native Americans in recent years. It started in the late 70s when Cherokee Geary Hobson identified a white shaman type that kept appearing in literature. Generally white, Euro-Christian American background poets who, in their poems, he says, assume the persona of the shaman, usually in the guise of an American Indian medicine man. Another poet and critic, Wendy Rose, expanded on Hobson's critique, identifying the roots of this literary production in anthropology, interestingly enough, saying that the people who like to think critically about culture really get bored with their own and exoticize other ones and tend to bring back into their home culture these romanticized notions of a primal or an indigenous culture with real roots and community or something really authentic to spice up what we see as a very boring and non-breathing room kind of white liberal life. Rose makes clear the economic foundations of such cultural appropriations, which means you have to have advantage over someone to go and study them, basically. Like Rose, critic Ward Churchill also identified the material bases of this spiritual hucksterism. He critiques the imagined primitivism of the Robert Bly-led men's movement, you know, the banging drums and dancing around in the forest, as a solution to white men's ennui or problems. The movement's hobbyist approach, he called it, to Native peoples and their cultures, complies with and even advances Native genocide, he states, by lulling white liberals into denial. So it's interesting. These Native critics accuse white liberals of who use Native culture to reinvigorate their own and cite their own resistance as performing a really anti-liberal, even imperialist gesture. So, you know, they're saying, don't come looking for our culture to talk about your resistance because you're just reenacting so many hundred years of colonization, which I think is something we have to take seriously, I mean, especially in the context of Mormonism and proselyting, things like this. Native American critiques like these occupy one site of conversation in what has become a global discussion of the proper use of indigenous cultural forms. Everyone from Benetton, you know, to Missoula Oil way back when uses indigenous people to pitch products as the real thing, or, you know, the good thing, the pure thing. Specifically, the deployment of indigenous culture in the service of political agendas has received in-depth attention. Materialist critics worldwide, that's a fancy word for Marxist, because no one can say Marxist anymore, especially in Utah, have observed that the production and distribution of culture can sustain and enforce systems of economic dominance, or, conversely, activate sites of local resistance. So the behavior of men's movement, you know, rich white men from America who trance around like Indians, is seen as an appropriation of cultural capital by an already privileged class who have really no material alignment or investment in the cultures they purchase, they use. But at the same time, this contact with and use of indigenous cultural forms, critics say, makes possible some new and really interesting kinds of alliance building among indigenous people, and more flexible and less containable and predictable kinds of resistance. Gayatri Spivak, again, has coined the term strategic essentialism to denote local political mobilizations and organizations which claim power by identifying themselves with other oppressed populations or with the fiction of a unified insurgent consciousness. To translate, strategic essentialism is when we say, we're really Mormon, whatever Mormon means. We're so essentially Mormon, and what we do is essentially Mormon, or I'm this is a black thing. See, and that's really useful politically sometimes. But what does it mean when we say, I'm really Mormon, watch me do the Indian thing? Okay, that's the question I want to talk about here today. Lots of theorists have been talking about this kind of thing. What kind of alliances can we build, and what problems are there when we borrow and when we hybrid and cross-pollinate? George Lipsitz, another culture materialist, talked about these sites of exchange of culture as dangerous crossroads, and they yield a mixed bag. They can make you stronger and build your alliances or make you just into another colonizer. I think the really important part of being careful about how we use other people's cultures to talk about our own resistance is something Gayatri Spivak expands upon, where she talks about the strategy having to suit a situation. So we can't always go running to Indian culture, for example, to say, oh, you know, when I say resistant, I'm going to wear my fetish beads and bang a drum. If it's profitable at a certain juncture and we're working with Native American people on an issue that they're concerned about too, that's a different story. But if we're always running to, like, claim Indian every time we feel left out of Mormonism, that's a problem. Political strategies grounded in local knowledge empower local people to resist and to make change. Such moves affect a redistribution of cultural capital, making every local a potential critic or agent, and at the same time, decentering hostile, hegemonic cultural authority. So using these local cultural forms means everybody kind of knows their own story and their own culture. And so everyone can identify when we use what we have to cite our resistance. If we use really foreign and exotic stuff, not everyone knows what you're doing. I think this really applies to Mormon intellectualism in some ways. I'm going to go straight to the Williams section, straight to the specific Mormon feminism issue here. Mormon feminists, I believe, have no other alternative than to effect these kind of multiple alliances and to reach out to other groups. I really think that our future is in networking and identifying with wider coalitions of women. I think we've made important political progress in the development of our own local cultural resistance, especially through this kind of historical recovery of women's agency in the 19th century with all the washings and anointings and the blessings and our new understanding of the role women played back then. But that's not enough to save us, I don't think. I think we do need to build these alliances. But my concern in our alliance building is that we don't replicate the very methods of, you know, erasure of agency and taking over other people's business and silencing other people, which we seek to counteract in our own culture. So with this concern, I turn to examine Terry Tempest Williams and Refuge. As a strategist first and as a theorist second, I want to assess the territorial complexities of Williams' use of New Age and Native American forms. And what does it mean to Mormon women to say we're a border tribe? And does a kind of essentialist identification with Shoshone women redistribute cultural agency in a way that empowers all involved? Or does Williams' text, like those of, you know, Men's Movement, Robert Bly, etc., just constitute a romantic neocolonial appropriation of Indian people's forms? As an adequate examination of Mormon and Indian political and economical and theological interface is beyond the scope of this paper. However, in order to make scrupulous, as Gayatri Spivak would ask, the political interests involved, I will say the following, that I think the material conditions which determine how we relate to Indian folks need to be examined, and that Mormon immigration to Utah, I think, was a forced migration, and we can't identify on that basis. But I think that our own romantic theological consideration of indigenous peoples, all this Lamanite stuff, which I'm just not sure is ever theologically grounded. I'm not certain about it. It's my belief that it's neither central to nor substantiated by Mormon canonical doctrine. But I think that we've had, because we were both forced out, we both lived out here in the boondocks in the middle of the heat, and we both hated the U.S. government, there were some strategic alignments that we can claim with Native people. And some of our alignments, like farming collectives, maybe read as benign, but others, like aggressive proselyting, I think, incurred heavy costs among local peoples. But looking at it, our situation now, though we've had this historical commonality, I think the prosperity that Mormon people have attained compared to the enduring poverty of Indian peoples should call us to a very careful examination of what we're doing today. Thus, I understand Williams as a white upper-middle-class Mormon to occupy a position of advantage. At the same time, she is in a position of disadvantage and resistance derived specifically from her situation as a Mormon woman and residually from her history of Mormons as kind of this people with this, we're out of the United States, we've been driven out, a resistant people. So she's hybrid, right? She's both in a position of advantage and a position of disadvantage. So how is she going to establish in this double position a relationship with Native peoples, and how is she going to use their forms to cite her own resistance? Her fascination with Indian folks started way back in a book called Pieces of White Shell, A Journey to Navajo Land, when she writes, "I'm reminded by a Shoshone friend that I come to the Navajo as a migrating bird, lighting for only brief periods of time. This is true, but it is also true that the lessons I learned come from similar places. No one culture has dominion over birdsong. We all share the same sky." So Williams continues claiming commonality, saying we both come from the same place, we live in the same desert, we both look at the sky the same way. Both cultures are caught between modernization and tradition. She says both cultures are spiritual, both cultures think of place as sacred. She also identifies differences. She talks about the way we walk on the earth being different and the way we tell stories being different. And so she cautions her readers against this outright easy appropriation, grab your rattle, and let's go talk to the guys at the church office building. She says, "I am not suggesting we emulate Native peoples, in this case the Navajo. We can't. We are not Navajo. Besides, their traditional stories don't work for us. It's like drinking another man's medicine. Their stories hold meaning for us only as examples. They can teach us what is possible. We must create and find our own stories, our own myths, with symbols that will bind us to the world as we see it today. In doing so, we will better know how to live our lives in the midst of change." Recognizing narrative propriety and emphasizing that strategic and significant storytelling is a local event, insisting that cultural survival depends upon appropriate local deployment of culture, Williams seems careful and conscious. But her chapter one signifies a whole different attitude. Even its opening line, she says, "I'm a collector. Right? I'm going over there to collect stuff." Williams makes every attempt in Navajo land to identify and credit her Native informants and include historical accounts of all that the Navajos have suffered. But her real politic predictions are weaved into the book's broader romance. As a trained naturalist and museum curator, Williams' well-honed expedition instinct seems to determine her overall relation to Navajo land. As this coinage, Navajo land, suggests, Williams has a hard time differentiating her method of investigation into geological formations and her mode of interaction with local residents. So people are just like rocks. We go and we learn stuff and we take it back home to where we are. At one point, she stops to ask Navajo holy man Herb Blatchford if it was inappropriate, she said, quote, "for a non-Indian to use Indian stories to illustrate a land ethic." "No, it does not offend me," he says, "but it may some." A few paragraphs later, she calls her journey into Navajo land a periodic pilgrimage. She uses words like pure and real to qualify the experience. She claims that oral tradition is one step from being lost. Reading along and following these reflective meanderings from rock to Navajo schoolchild to tree, Terry just wandering through the desert, her oscillations from responsible self-interrogation and ostensibly egalitarian conversation to wild romanticism, it's really overwhelming. It's a relief, finally, when Williams returns to her museum post in Salt Lake City. She comes, she collects, and she leaves. She has the option of leaving Navajo land behind and the option to return at will. She is not tied to its impoverished economy, and she's not responsible for its political disenfranchisement. Her privileged, kind of optional, study relationship to Navajo land makes her, you know, refuge in Navajo land seem kind of indulgent and neocolonial to me. And, I mean, this is all due respect to Terry Tempest Williams. This is just an examination of things that I think cripple us as Mormons sometimes. Williams has no such options of flight when it comes to refuge. The territory she covers in refuge is her own. It's her home. It's riddled with political and spiritual pitfalls and pockmarked with graves. Tracing her lineage through the Mormon emigrant handcart companies of the 1850s, Williams writes, "Genealogy is in our blood. As a people and a family, we have a sense of history, and our history is tied to land." Her later descriptions of the history of the land, her family's history, effaced the land's prior occupation by Shoshones and Utes. Isolation, she writes, is just what Mormons were looking for, a land no one else wanted. A few paragraphs later, she casually mentions that wolves and Indian raids destroyed her family's livestock. Indians get naturalized in this part of the history, appearing as forces of nature, but not as fellow subjects or fellow thinkers or fellow tenants, even. William's story advances to and through the current day. She nurses her mother through terminal cancer, watches the Salt Lake swell. Things get tense, and the Indians show up again. William's nephew Hank lends mother his medicine beads for the pain. A little magic never hurts, William says. Seeking her own cure, Williams takes off for a week-long dig at Anasazi State Park to find remnants of a now-extinct tribe. They find petroglyphs, a warrior, a woman, something of their spirit remains, she says. Flip forward a few pages, and Williams and her husband are vacationing in Vancouver with a friend who is documenting endangered killer whales. And in a scene that just reminds me of Conrad's colonial masterpiece, Heart of Darkness, Williams and her husband jump ship and go onto this island, entering the lush and ancient forest. And suddenly, she writes, three boxes, three skulls. The pair encounter the disintegrating bones of the island's former native inhabitants. These are the old ways of a Northwest Indian people, she says. We don't want to stay long or disturb what we see. It's not long until Williams arrives at another island, this time floating island in the salt flats of northwestern Utah. She's again an archaeological expedition member, again seeking artifacts of a dead tribe. She cites anthropological theory and considers the rising Salt Lake, musing that, quote, in many ways, the Fremont had more options than we have facing natural fluctuation and change. Again, this devaluation of Mormon or white culture, not taking account of our own strategies in favor of romanticization of native peoples, which I think turns around to cripple us in the end. The archaeologists find a remarkable artifact, a ceremonial necklace made of birds' feet. Can't you see them dancing around the fire? William says to her companion, dressed in feathers with a shrill cry of bone whistles in the air. Her companion makes a face. And where are these feathered robes and bone whistles now, he asks. Ironically, it is an archaeologist that provides relief from this never-ending romantic expedition to places coded dead Indian, in fact. But the relief is short-lived. The expedition celebrates its last night by crafting fake necklaces from plastic forks, and someone throws magic dust on the fire, and everyone dances like a tribesman, she says. Artifacts, William concludes, celebrate our instinctive desire for adornment, even power and prestige. What power, one might wonder, in someone else's artifacts? Mother's health worsens, and Williams is called home. Mother dies. She visits a friend's Salt Lake City trading post, and the friend produces a pair of deerskin moccasins, ankle-high and fully beaded, including the soles, which were an intricate design of snakes, Williams reports. An Indian woman who had been browsing, smelling the baskets of sweet grass, and there's all this exotic detail, quietly walks over to the counter, and the unnamed woman, who identifies herself as Cherokee, explains that the shoes are burial moccasins, and the storekeeper corroborates. Williams responds to the Cherokee woman's explanations by sharing Mormon rituals for dressing the dead, ceremonial white dress, slippers, green apron, and veil. She doesn't buy the moccasins. I think this is one of the most graceful considerations and negotiations in the whole book. Indians come up only sporadically in the balance of the text. One Sunday, fleeing an important semi-annual church conference for a foray into the desert, Williams calls herself a native. Williams' aunt, also a cancer victim, compares her mastectomy scars to native scarification rituals. Williams views eggshells at the Museum of National History, finding them to be blown hollow. She says this collection is a sacrilege, the exposed medicine bundles of a tribe. She returns from the land of dead native tribes to face death among her own, and it's only then that her formerly insatiable appetite for artifacts seems to subside. The epilogue, The Clan of One-Breasted Women, maintains a more measured, less romantic tone, and I think it's more hopeful, more helpful to those of us who actually have to live here and deal with Mormon culture all the time. She carefully and critically details the history of nuclear testing in Nevada and the federal government's denial of same. She reports the results of class action compensation lawsuits and subsequent overturning of those, you know, Supreme Court decisions on the basis of sovereign immunity. Comparing the inarguable sovereignty of Mormon church leaders to that of the U.S. government, Williams explains, in Mormon culture, authority is respected, obedience is revered, and independent thinking not. I was taught as a young girl not to make waves or rock the boat, she writes. So she's being as careful as if she were testifying before Congress. She finally relates how she has, for years, kept quiet while she nursed her mother, her aunts, and her grandmothers through this cancer into their graves. She concludes that such complicity is no longer possible in a very famous quote now, which reads, what I do know, however, is that as a Mormon woman of the fifth generation of Latter-day Saints, I must question everything, even if it means losing my faith, even if it means becoming a member of a border tribe among my own people. This border region, Williams continues, the deserts, have been classified as virtually uninhabited by government officials. My family and the birds of the Great Salt Lake, she says, were some of those virtual uninhabitants. One night, Williams begins her very next paragraph, I dreamed women from all over the world circled a blazing fire in the desert. And so we're jarred from this astonishingly engaged clarity back into a dreamscape, back into a reverie. In an almost classic scene of pan-tribal feminist romance, you know, all feminists are red, we're all beat your drum kind of thing, the women dance and drum and promise that they will never fear the witch inside themselves. They begin to sing a song given to them by Shoshone grandmothers. William Prince and translates the song, consider the rabbits, it suggests. The women, like rabbits, sense tremors from nuclear testing. Stretch marks appear on the land. Bombs become stillborns. The women walk through the deserts towards town to protest, to testify that, quote, to deny one's genealogy with the earth was to commit treason against one's soul. The women wear mylar and clear masks and float through town like apparitions. When soldiers arrest them and lead them away, blindfolded and handcuffed, they sing up reinforcements with the old Shoshone song. Later in her acknowledgments, she thanks the Shoshone women who I was fortunate enough to cross the line with at the Nevada test site for giving her their song. One wonders why we couldn't have heard the song directly from them, as they sang with Williams at the test site. One wonders why the romantic depiction, why this surrealism, why Williams' consciousness had to mediate so heavily. One wonders what is to be strategically gained or lost in the casting of bicultural political resistance as dream. Certainly, not every reader is as stringent as I am and demands that Terry Tempest Williams produce good strategy. Some, I'm sure, are pretty content with her good fiction. But as a co-member of Williams' border tribe, I, like her, must question everything, especially authority, especially in the form of authorial intervention. If a book is uncritical about its history of place, how much should I trust its mapping? If a book involves Indians only as artifacts, how eagerly should I run to a refuge written in Shoshone language? And if denying one's genealogy signifies suicide, how do I sustain my mother and my daughters with an incommunicable cure, one whose syllables are foreign, one whose syllables I can't even pronounce? I find refuge in refuge when Williams effectively stands and bears testimony, as we always do on the first Sunday of the month. Though her testimony differs from mine, the performance is familiar, and the resistance is practical. Sustainable resistance, I know, depends on the strength of living sisters, not the magic of museum pieces. You know, a lot of us have crossed the line in Nevada, and a lot of us have fled Sunday sacrament meetings for the desert or the mountains or the beach or anywhere. When Williams stands and testifies on her own cultural ground, she simultaneously identifies and marks that other border Mormons can recognize. We all kind of know what that feels like, to run away for Sunday, to feel like a border tribe. But no such luck with Vancouver, Fremont spelunking, or Mylar wrapped dreamscape. They provide little comfort for those of us, you know, who face church courts in Utah or less grave but still serious things like how to deal today. You know, Mylar isn't going to do it today for me. Williams' Indian romances aren't strategic. Her mapping of the Mormon borderlands, literally as desert, figuratively as descent, is strategic. So recognizing that we share some uninhabitable territory with Native American women, culturally in our mutual disenfranchisement, and materially via both of us have been displaced people, and recognizing that we do have some economic advantage, we have to also recognize our obligation as we use Native American tropes and types in our resistance to account for the contact that produced these things. I mean, this means for me in practical terms, you know, and as an organizer and an activist in multicultural communities in Los Angeles, choosing to limit what culture I borrow from other people to the boundaries of my material commitment to those people, only telling stories I've been given by people and always acknowledging the source. It means critically accounting for the conditions which situate me as a writer or as a thinker or as someone who can give papers. It means choosing locally understood forms that empower people around me to play along rather than being really veiled and exotic about things. I don't think that really helps build a left community. Refuge makes its Indian contact in two ways, and I'll be brief on this part. First of all, there's all the artifacts she comes up with, right? All the dead Indian stuff. you know, looking at it from a Native American point of view, I mean, that's not mine, but the kind of criticism you would hear in a class, what does it mean for Indians always to show up dead? And why do we want to practice a resistant by just holding up the magic bean or whatever that's dead and it's not in action? It doesn't really empower anyone. Whenever Terry Tempest Williams adds to her literary collection of Native souvenirs, she threatens to turn refuge from a resilient, self-sustaining ecosystem into a dead and cold museum. But the second type, when she talks about acting like an Indian or occupying a border space, that's an active type of Native identification. It's interesting, reading Refuge and then reading around in UCLA's American Indian Library and looking for kind of these intersections of Mormon and Indian culture, and boy, they've got some interesting books. Things written and published by those little presses in Pleasant Grove about how Native Americans are really Mormons and, you know, tying it all in with herbal healing and buy your herbs at this store kind of thing. They have a lot of interesting things about Mormon and Indian contact. And just digging around through that and considering the difference between using Native culture as a charm and saying, oh, I'm liberal, look, I've got a rattle, or actually acting out and walking with Shoshone people or, you know, politically being an activist with people of color, I found some interesting topology that's actually ours, that's actually historical in issues of Indian-Mormon contact. Richard Burton explains in his 1862 Western travel epic, City of the Saints, that in 1837, a now familiar band of young Mormon men known as Danites, but also known as Daughters of Gideon and Destroying Angels, formed for the purpose of dealing as avengers of blood with the Gentiles. And so we all know the Danites came together during the really intense mob violence, which culminated in the Helen's Mill and the Missouri Extermination Order and attempted to ward off such attacks. And I'm not a good historian, so forgive me if I'm massacring it, but that's how I understand it. They attempted to ward off such attacks with the threat of swift vigilante retaliation. Burton further recorded that Danites typically, quote, assumed savage disguises, and that the phrase, he has met the Indians, circulated proverbially in Utah to mean that one had been killed by the Danites. White Indian sightings, and that's how he says it, white Indians, how Burton writes it, are scattered throughout Burton's travelogue. The Indians are either described as messengers of divine judgment and justice or as common thieves. Mormon Indians appear again at Mountain Meadows, of course, in 1857, with federal armies marching towards Salt Lake City to put down what the government believed to be insurrection. We treated Gentile immigrants who passed through with distrust, and tensions escalated to lead in the Mormon-led massacre of an Arkansas wagon train. Some accounts claim that the Mormons dressed as Indians to commit the murders. Some claim that Mormons and local Paiutes actually worked together. Either way, here's the Mormon Indian striking again as a messenger of justice and vengeance. Frontier writer John Young Nelson also reports encountering a Mormon Indian of a slightly different kind in southern Utah in 1859. Nelson writes of meeting a band of Indians. When one of them, he writes, a tremendously tall fellow, asked me in broken English where I was going and if I was a Mormon. I saw at a glance that he was a white man, although he was painted, and guessed he was one of the fanatical renegade destroying angels whose mission it was to kill every white man not belonging to the sect, and particularly those who were apostates. After stopping and passing the evening with the band, he decided that this man was not a Danite, but had been, quote, driven out of the Mormon community for some crime and had found refuge with these Utes, who numbered from 50 to 60, all told. So the Mormon legacy of Indian-identified resistance, it keeps going. It persists through the ghost dance movement of the late 19th century, when Native nationalists in northern Nevada used some messianic rhetoric and actually converged with some Mormon millennialist expectations that 1890 was the year it was all gonna come down and Christ would return. A Native informant reports that the whites and the Indians danced together in northern Nevada, and Mormon proximity to and missionary work among the Paiutes of northern Nevada, from whose tribe the Messiah, Wovoka was his name, Jack Wilson, came, led many government officials to accuse the Mormons of actually inciting the ghost dances. So again, we have Western local resistance where Mormons and Indians are in cahoots, working together, dancing together, moving together, taking refuge maybe in these border areas together. So the type of the Mormon Indian then has some history for us. It may not be history we're immediately current or familiar with, but nonetheless it's ours. It's territorially deployed in moments of severe cultural crisis and danger to enforce justice and deliver the judgment of God. So Williams' invocation of this typology, though perhaps unwitting, provides Mormon dissidents with a folk consciousness mapping of their resistance. Throughout Mormon cultural history, these uninhabitable border territories have sheltered everyone from renegade polygamists to people escaping excommunication in our years. This mapping then sets the stage for an incredible table turning. Whereas the Danai-affiliated Indians and polygamous husbands who occupied the Indian borders were protectors of and adherents to traditional authority, William's feminist Indians could engage male authority from the borderlands of belief. In the context of a cultural consciousness formed under and solidified by exodus and persecution, the border is an extremely important place for us as Mormon leftists. And if we're careful about how we make contact with border peoples and how we use border culture, and make sure that it's our own. You know, we don't have to exoticize other traditions and kill them off and use them as artifacts to make interesting cultural contact and resistant cultural performance. We have our own thing we can rely on. The idea, leaving William specifically, and just some general thoughts before I close, the idea of culture as revolution really is not a new one. I mean, most of us are familiar with it, just popularly, Chairman Mao and the Cultural Revolution in China. Hence the title, Mao in the title, like the donut holes, I think, one of the most interesting juxtapositions I could think of. Raymond Williams, a cultural theorist of this century, has talked about how the residual parts of our culture, what we forget sometimes, also provides the most resistant parts. And Bill Martin, who's giving a paper concurrently with my session, has written in Sunstone very recently about the fact that our culture, what is our own in Mormon, is probably one of our strongest sites for identification and resistance. In practical terms, for me, I think this means three things. First of all, the anti-historical trend which seems to characterize most Mormon proceedings, most official stuff, needs to be reversed. We need to dive into our history, I think, as people like Michael Quinn and a large group of Mormon historians do, and again awaken our collective memory that we were driven out of the United States. We were very anti-authoritarian. I mean, the militias bring this back in an eerie way, but that we have cause to identify with distressed peoples. Though it be residual, though we now enjoy great economic advantage, this is part of our culture. And I think that's something that I was really glad to hear Gordon B. Hinckley talk about at last conference, about standing with the victims of bigotry wherever they are. That's good. We should be doing that. We had extermination orders signed on us by the U.S. government, more than 100 years ago. But still, this should be part of our cultural memory. We should be distrustful of grand narratives, capitalism. We should be distrustful of centralized government. Not necessarily militias, but we should retain our residual consciousness as a formerly oppressed people. I think that would provide those of us who are skeptical and those who are leftist and resistant some justification, saying this is not a newfangled thing. This is Mormon. This is really Mormon. Mormons distrust central stuff. We left for a reason. Second, within Mormonism, I think calling up these cultural things that are familiar to us all can provide us in the left some great comfort, because it is kind of weird to try to interpolate yourself within leftist politics on a wider scale. And how does one do that? Everyone thinks Mormons are retarded. You know, everyone thinks we're just... I told a friend, I'm coming to a Mormon intellectual conference this week, and he's like, contradiction in terms. But I think things like, you know, the Mormon Alliance's roadshow, you know, Feminist Home Evening, which was a central part of my experience at BYU. We met every Monday night, and we studied feminist theory together at Cecilia's house, which formed probably one of the most comforting and important sites of my, you know, Mormon left affiliation, most enduring memories I have. Treats. We should have treats at everything. We should serve Y Sparkle. We should have donut holes. We should make ourselves feel comfortable and not alienated within our own culture. In this way, we'll also feel comfortable, seem more Mormon to people who are distrustful of us. You know, it's not that Y Sparkle is going to change everything. But we should think about especially making our public demonstrations of resistance typically Mormon. You know, is there something we can resurrect from our culture that people who don't understand the left and are distrustful of intellectuals will read as something very familiar? I think of three examples. Cecilia, in one of her pro-choice speeches, I mean, although she got bulldozed, of course these strategies don't mean you're not going to get your butt kicked in the end, it scripted her pro-choice investment as, I say hands off, very useful, very useful. And people got to nod along with that. That is true. That's what Utah Pioneer said, so she still got it in the end, but, you know, interesting. And two other non-Mormon stories. Rigoberta Menchú's writing about her resistance in Central America, she talks about how she used the apocryphal Book of Judith to empower women in her community as to how they could be really involved in, you know, in the very active and almost sometimes very violent political struggle. I see we go in the Old Testament, resurrect some of that stuff. Who was it? Jail to put the nail through the ear? You know, I mean, old stories are good. People recognize those. We've all been educated in that stuff from a long time back. So using these old and familiar, very Mormon, or very, you know, scriptural stories and manipulating them mercilessly to our own political ends is something we should do. There's no reason to go around and identify with, you know, some alienated left culture where we all wear black and whatever. You know, that's not going to serve us, and it doesn't make us feel any better. One more example is from a Korean woman's, a Korean feminist theologian's essay I read, where she talked about in her Bible, you know, this is her culture, her book. In her Bible, she took a pen and cut out passages from Paul she didn't like. And so when anyone told her, well, it's in the Bible, she says, it's not in mine. It's not in mine. Again, her cultural form, she didn't have to go citing some feminist theorist no one had ever heard of to justify herself, because no one trusts those weirdos anyway. She could say, well, it doesn't say it in my book. Manipulating what we have and making it our own, inscribing ourselves right in Mormon culture. We're not external to it. We're a central part of it. So that'll give us a great degree of comfort. And the third application I see is the strategic side of strategic essentialism. As Mormon leftists, I'm convinced we've got to leave. Don Noren used to say about the Student Review that it was always talking to its navel. We've got to leave our solipsism. There's things we're not going to change here anytime in the near future. Nancy Rushforth, Sam Rushforth's wife, used to say, social change happens when people die. Okay, so with our church structure, I don't know what it's going to do to bang our heads against the wall of the Granite Church office building. I really don't. And sometimes I think it's very frustrating, and it's just very exhausting. I think we must integrate ourselves within the wider political landscape, not just as Mormon leftists, but as Mormon leftists, or Mormon liberals. I think we can do this in very important ways, especially with the Christian right coming up. I mean, now is the time for believing people to resist what I consider really taking the name of the Lord in vain. I really consider it taking the name of the Lord in vain. You know, and to stand up as believing people and be as Christian and Mormon as you can. People think Mormons are fundamentalists. You know, and stand up and say, no, I'm a Mormon. I'm a right-wing Christian. Claim that strategically, essentially. And I don't believe that. That's not my Jesus. I think we need to be vocal. I think we need to be really vocal, because that's very dangerous stuff. Passing off hate politic in the name of our Lord. It just amazes me. Anyway. Other places we can use Mormonism to shake up and to serve our leftist interests. A group of us Mormon feminists went and did clinic defense a few months ago down in Los Angeles when Operation Rescue was in town. Again, you have people carrying crosses and claiming Jesus and blah, 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 blah. You know, doing a rosary prayer on the sidewalk, really mobilizing these very, very powerful religious symbols to serve a very right-wing and limited interest. We need to respond in kind. We made our sign that said, Mormon Women for Choice, and carried it around, and an AP reporter stopped us and said, are you kidding? You're serious? And people responded and were heartened. We need to, you know, join coalitions with other peoples of faith in these issues and claim and shake people up and say, yeah, I'm Mormon, and I'm for choice. Strategically essentializing our identity, you know, in service of a leftist agenda. Because the right does not have all ownership of religion. We got to remember that, because religion is powerful in this country. It's powerful symbolism. We need to use that and use our Mormonism and subvert these types people have of us as right-wing reactionaries, our own culture in the service of a progressive agenda. One more thing, we also need to organize the working class. Mormons are a trash culture. I mean, we are not old money. You know, I mean, we left all that old money and put the apple seeds in the back of the handcart and walked here, most of us. And I'm referring to a small group of Utah, you know, or Utah Pioneer Root people. But, you know, a lot of at least my Arizona ancestor converts were down-home, working-class people. Again, we need to use our resistant sensibility to help carve out and talk to people in our home wards in a very down-home way that's not militia-oriented, but at the same time, it's suspicious of people who are obviously politicking and will be in the coming years with issues of race and gender, and saying, I'm just real suspicious of those politicians. You know, these are right-wing politicians we can be suspicious of, too. They're just bad, and I think they don't understand working-class people. We need to talk down-home. We need to occupy our own culture as resistance, because I think we're selling ourselves short if we don't. Mormonism is activism. I mean, No one can make ward lists better. No one can get people out to the cannery like Mormons can. These are all things that we know how to do. We're trained. We're trained to mobilize. And I think that's where we need to go with our own culture and do so confidently. Thanks. Is my moderator here? Did Lindsay ever get? Okay, so I think, well, you guys should all go, because unless you want to talk, questions, discussion, next thing starts at 11. Yeah.
No, right. I don't even get it. I think I'm just one of
them. I think one of the biggest.
I'm saying things out loud, like, no, I really disagree with you. Like,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, but, you know,
I think one of the... Something I found, actually, that works, and this ties right in with another just great Mormon tradition, is genealogy and family stories. I mean, the history that is centralized and presented to us as Come, Come, Ye Saints is different than our lived lives sometimes. And so we can say Come, Come, Ye Saints and sound just like everybody else. But if we say, hell, when my grandmama converted in, you know, Arizona way back in the ho-dunk days, you know, and talk about our family stories, you know, and how complex and difficult situations have been for us, and talk about, in these personal terms, lived experience. Right. Right. And family stories are very Mormon, they're very comfortable and very Mormon. You're not being a leftist vanguard weirdo if you talk about who's Majigger in Idaho. You know, that's lived experience. People can't take that. Yeah. Right. Right. That's one of the downfalls of relying upon common culture, is assuming that we all have a common culture. And I think a lot of us who come to Sunstone do. You know, I mean, we don't see here a lot of inner-city Mormons. We don't see a lot of really new crop Mormons. We don't see a lot of Latin American Mormons here, okay? We have a unique situation, though, I think. Those of us who do come to Sunstone feel a particular cultural need to identify really as Salt Lake Mormon in some ways. Otherwise, we'd just be doing our own thing, maybe. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, it can come in subtle ways, too. I mean, it can be as easy as bringing a petition to homemaking night, you know, going to homemaking night. I mean, homemaking nights are changing everywhere in the church, you know, I mean. The literacy effort that the Relief Society sponsors, I mean, bring something good to read. You know, when you're teaching them to read, bring something good. Maybe make the literacy effort in your ward, you know, make them read Maxine Hong Kingston, The Woman Warrior, or something like that. I mean, we have some revolutionary kind of programs and ideals in place. There you go. It's just a matter of being creative and not expecting too much of ourselves. Because, you know, I'm going to talk to my mother for the rest of my life, and she's still going to be Republican. You know? Yeah. Well, I think you can even do it through common sense. I mean, I think you can even script it through common sense about the modern issue. Like, hell, I'm not I mean, we're not an American church anymore. Like, you know, we're sending all these kids out to foreign missions, and we got more, you know, Spanish-speaking members. And, I mean... Right. No, true, but again, it's not about, the idea of strategic essentialism, and this is something I didn't really go into the whole theory of, it's not about always being pure, it's about being strategic. You know, it's not always about having to be exactly right in everything, it's about getting through. And, you know, winning a little here and winning a little here, but not always having to be totally accurate. I don't call that lying, I call it survival. You know, I mean, being strategic, talking one way to who you need to talk to. And, you know, we all know that we have a lot of gains to make and that things are problematic. But you get through how you got to. What? It's not lying. Strategy. I mean, everyone's used to having the weird person in the ward, you know, or the Jack Mormon. You know, I mean, I think maybe these are categories that we could, if we just felt a little more confident in ourselves, I wouldn't care if anyone called me the ward Jack. I mean, if they knew that I was just going to come and show up and help paint their house next Saturday, and maybe I'd do a little proselytizing when I was there. But, you know, just keeping involved in our community, as you say, and not ostracizing ourselves and having faith. I mean, it's a depressing place to be sometimes, but, you know, livening it up. Yeah. Yeah, I think we're out. We need to make room for the next people. Thank you very much.